For those of you who do have little ones, the Bay Area has a lot of preschools for you. There are close to 200 in San Francisco alone. And that's not even counting Head Start programs, which operate in all 50 states. Many people believe that Head Start was America's first government-run educational program for young children, and it launched back in 1964. But during World War II, there was an earlier model, and it started right here in the city of Richmond. Sam Redman interviewed students and teachers who were in these prototype childcare centers on behalf of the Bancroft Library's Regional Oral History Office at UC Berkeley. Redman recently visited KALW, where he spoke with Stephen Short about the project.
One of the many people that we talked to actually had a pretty multidimensional experience with the schools. A man named Tom Powers was once a student at the centers, but his mom, Ruth Powers, was also a teacher there. So he got an experience from both of those perspectives. But then later he returned while he was in high school, a young man. He became a student teacher there. So he had a perspective then a few years later of what the schools were like.
Well, so let's hear that clip from Tom Powers.
Child care centers, they were all identical in shape and structure. They had the same food. They had the same teaching plans. They were very, everything was done in great detail. And, you know, it turned out that they were very good. Having children do art at age 3 and 4, I mean, that's a, and it was very regimented art programs.
Sam, that was Tom Powers, who started his education in one of these government-run preschool centers. And he mentions that art was very good for these children, but then he also said that it was highly structured. Well, art isn't supposed to be highly structured. I mean, it's supposed to be free, isn't it? Can you explain this?
Sure. So there was a really innovative art practitioner and teacher named Monica Haley, who was introducing ideas about how art was developmental in children. So 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, and 4-year-olds paint alike and go through various stages of cognitive development, and it's expressed in their art. And the context of wartime influenced this heavily. One of my colleagues at the Oral History Office recorded an interview with Patricia Wilson, who's a former teacher who talks about the art program.
I don't think that there was a focus, but it would happen that the children would be aware. They would hear their parents or, you know, they knew that this was going on, and they would portray it. Airplanes, dropping bombs, something to do with the theme of warfare. And the teachers would encourage them to express themselves that way.
That was Patricia Wilson telling us about the importance of art in these centers. I'm talking with Sam Redmond, who's from UC Berkeley's Regional Oral History Office. I'm Stephen Short. Now, Sam, what can you tell us about the population that was going to these schools? Who were these families? We've already said they've inundated poor little Richmond.
Right. Well, as we've mentioned, there's actually a great headline for an article that would appear later in Fortune magazine called Richmond Took a Beating, that I think is actually indicative of the experience of the city. It grew exponentially in terms of population, and about 27% of the workforce at Kaiser were women. And many of these women had children. And many of the women were from California, but many of the women were from elsewhere. And they participated in this massive migration of people to urban centers especially, but many of them out west, Los Angeles and the Bay Area and Seattle, experienced a massive growth along with the defense industries that were growing up and building for this Pacific War. And Richmond especially, it grew in terms of size, but it also grew in terms of diversity of who was there. And many people who moved in were from the Jim Crow South and were of a different racial background and also had a different experiences surrounding race and race relations. We recorded a great interview with a former teacher and a student together, and some of their memories bouncing off one another. It's actually a really great setting. This is an interview with Ruth Hoffman, a former teacher, and O'Neill Dillon, who incidentally became a lead psychiatrist on death row at San Quentin Prison, but is now retired and is incidentally a volunteer at the Rose of the Riveter National Park now. But they shared some of their experiences and recollections about how people got along at the school.
Well, let's hear that now.
We had an incident. We had a new teacher, and she happened to be black, okay? And she was assigned to our room. This one day, I remember the kid, Morgan Cooley. His mother came to pick him up, and the mother said that she was taking him out because of the teacher.
Because she was black?
And I said to her, I'm very sorry to hear it. I said, Morgan was doing very well here, and she is one of our best teachers. And she was. She was really good. 2 weeks later, she comes back with Morgan. Morgan comes back.
That was the voice of Ruth Hoffman, who was a teacher at these child care centers in Richmond during World War II. And that second male voice that you heard was O'Neill Dillon, who was a former student of hers. Well, we're touching on the racial tension that all these people from all over the country and all kinds of creeds, colors, and everything all thrown together into the Great War effort. But certainly there were problems with that. What was the racial climate like in these close quarters in Richmond at that time?
Well, certainly these schools are popping up a full decade before Brown v. Board of Education would change the landscape of schools and the doctrine of separate but equal throughout the country. And certain places had different policies in racial integration, both, by law and both by social practice. But these schools gradually became increasingly diverse. And as the city of Richmond continued to become more and more diverse, they became a space where lots of people could get an early education, including Valvia Jefferson, who was one of the first African-Americans following the Brown v. Board of Education decision to officially start in a program and desegregate these schools. And she had a very interesting experience and remembers very powerfully her feelings and relationship to the school and the community.
At that time, the school was open, right, for the South Side, for Richmond, for the community. That's what it was for. And we bloomed. Everybody that came up out of there was someone we can look or maybe point our finger to. And I'm speaking of more recent, because from there we left and went to the other school, which was Mount Olive. Mm-hmm. And people like our councilman, John Ziesenhenny, the Livingstons, all of them went to that school. So it was like the children, are actually being nurtured all the way up. And these are our kids. Mm-hmm. And I felt as though that was something very special. All of the kids knew that they belonged to somebody.